I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. A box jellyfish was found on the New Jersey shore, which should make swimmers a little nervous. They have venomous tentacles that can be very painful if you get stung. Meanwhile, clinging jellyfish have been identified for the first time in New Jersey, and they can pack a potent punch. They prefer the calm waters of bays and estuaries popular with swimmers and boaters. So what is going on in the Garden State? We asked John Gaynor to join us. He's Associate Professor of Biology at Montclair State University, an authority on jellyfish. And Jack Gaynor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you as well. So what is this about these clinging jellyfish? Why are they being attracted to New Jersey?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one we hope to answer. We were quite shocked when we got the first call about a month ago that one of these was located. We assumed it was one of those fluke things, and within a week, we found hundreds of them on one northern river, the Shrewsbury River, which is a tidal river, which means it, you know, flows back and forth with tides, with the ocean, and one on the Manasquan River. So these are really nasty jellies compared to the jellies that most people are probably familiar with in Barnegat Bay, you know, if they travel to the Jersey Shore. So
nasty in what way?
Well, nasty in that the sting from this particular jellyfish, this clinging jellyfish, is quite severe, right? So the jellyfish that most people are probably familiar with, if they've vacationed at the Jersey Shore, you get a sort of a mild, irritating sting. It's certainly uncomfortable, but it's not going to land you in the hospital. The clinging jellyfish, on the other hand, we've already had one individual who looks like they were encountered one of these jellyfish at night swimming in the Shrewsbury River, and he ended up being hospitalized. And
wow,
this was a healthy 20-year-old college student who was in such pain that they had a control the pain with morphine, and he spent 2 days in the hospital. So, and when you listen to his, host of symptoms, it matches precisely what this clinging jellyfish is supposed to do. You know, with, in addition to sort of intense pain, sort of a burning and redness, a swelling or edema at the site of stinging. He had muscle cramps and muscle spasms throughout his whole body. So it was really, this is a very serious sting. The other part that is, I think, really sort of important to note here is that most people are, familiar with seeing jellyfish that look fairly large. This one is tiny. It's about an inch across when it's a full adult. It's, about the size of a dime. It's often described, but its bell is essentially transparent. So when you're looking in the water, it's almost impossible to see. So unless you know and have reports that it's around, you could go in the water and not know it's there and end up getting stung. So that's, I think, one of the, real concerns here. And that's why the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection has given us a 30-day sort of emergency grant to go out and survey to find exactly where these things are, the range and distribution of this clinging jelly in New Jersey waters.
And where are they? I read that they were attracted to things like eelgrass. Are there other places you might find one of these clinging jellyfish?
Well, they like, from what we can gather, and we've been talking with scientists who've been studying this as well in other parts of the globe, they like shallow estuaries, right? So they like things like Barnegat Bay. We haven't actually found them in Barnegat Bay yet, but they like quiet water. They don't like very rough sort of surf. So we don't think it's a problem at all along the beaches,
right,
in New Jersey, for example. But in the back bays, in these quiet estuaries, they love to sort of hang out in areas where there are submerged aquatic vegetation. So they especially love eelgrass, and we have lots of eelgrass in New Jersey waters. It's a very common aquatic plant. So the clinging jelly actually just sort of grabs onto the blade of this eelgrass and hangs out during the day with its tentacles sticking out. But at night, it releases itself from the grass. It floats up in a water column, and that's when you're probably more likely to encounter it if you were swimming in, one of these bays or estuaries where this clinging jellyfish was. So that just is something it does in its sort of life history, and we just don't have a lot of experience with it because this is the very first time anyone has seen it in New Jersey.
Sounds like you're saying don't swim in the eelgrass and don't swim at night.
Yeah, that's that's very good advice. But as I said, the ocean we think is absolutely fine. But we've been, you know, we've just started this week. In fact, we were out yesterday, and the team is out today again on the Manasquan River, and we're doing various types of sampling, primarily through these grass beds, looking to see if we can find more. And you know, we're also collecting samples, and we're doing a genetic analysis, and that's what my lab sort of specializes in, is looking at the DNA of these organisms for genetic identification and for looking at, you know, how they might vary in a population.
Are they attracted to things like docks and bulkheads, or are you likely to find them there?
Well, the ones that were first found on the Shrewsbury actually were identified by individuals finding them off of their docks. There's an interesting thing, you know, about the life history of jellyfish that most people are unaware of. But most people, when they think of jellies, they think of what essentially is the adult phase, right? It's what we call the medusa. It's the thing that is swimming around, right? So it's got sort of a bell with tentacles dangling off of it. But what you don't see is that there's a form of the jellyfish that is persistent that's called a polyp, right? So when these jellyfish reproduce in the water column, they produce these tiny little larvae that swim around for a day or two. They find a hard substrate like a dock, the underside of a dock or a bulkhead. They like sort of smooth, hard surfaces. And then that little polyp, when the conditions are right, it'll differentiate and actually produce lots of little baby jellyfish that are clonal. So it's really, when you have a jellyfish problem, you don't really have a jellyfish problem per se, because the adults all die off. But the polyps persist. In fact, for some species, we know these polyps can persist for many, many years. And so if they're established in an area, then you've got these polyps probably, you know, floating docks for jet skis and things like that are very, very common in, you know, back bays and waterways. The undersides of these floating docks are, you know, usually loaded with jellyfish polyps. So, in fact, that's one of the things we're looking for now. We're looking to see if, in fact, we can detect jellyfish polyps for this particular clinging jellyfish species.
Is there a predator for this species, or are we the predators for this species?
Well, the unusual thing about jellies is that they, in many systems, they're sort of the top predator, right? There's nothing that eats them, nothing that can destroy them.
Really?
But it again depends on the size of them. So, you know, in the ocean, the one predator that seems to love most jellies are sea turtles, right? So turtles love, you know, feeding on jellies out, but we don't get many sea turtles in Barnegat Bay or in our estuaries. But we had an interesting thing that happened in the lab the other day. So the jellyfish we normally work on, which is the one that's really been a problem for the last 20 years in New Jersey, is something called a sea nettle, right? So we've got populations of sea nettles, and we've always got sea nettles in the lab. So when we brought back some clinging jellies, my colleague who does this work with me, this is Dr. Paul Bologna, took one of the clinging jellies and put it in a small container with one of our sea nettles.
Wow.
And lo and behold, now the sea nettle's a lot bigger than the clinging jelly, but he ate the clinging jelly. So now sea nettles have a very bad reputation. Most people would like to see them just gone. But if it turns out that sea nettles feed on the clinging jelly, then actually that's probably the first good news we've gotten about sea nettles. And in fact, they may actually control the population of clinging jellies if they were to get out of hand. So
let me quickly reintroduce you. That's John Gaynor. He's associate professor of biology at Montclair State University, an authority on jellyfish. And we've been talking about these clinging jellyfish now discovered in the New Jersey area on some of the bays and estuaries. And if you want to join us at 1-888-477-9499. You certainly can. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jack, do you think that these clinging jellyfish, are they attracted to the warmer waters or the changed salinity of the waters of New Jersey?
We're not really sure, but, you know, there's been a real global shift in the last decade or two worldwide with jellyfish populations, and some of that jellyfish blooms, as they're called, have been ascribed to global warming. It could very well be that, you know, an increase, even a very, very slight increase in temperatures, allows some of these species to expand their range where they would normally be found. This one in particular, based on the DNA sequencing we've been doing, interestingly enough, looks like it actually, its origin is probably the Western Pacific, right? So the peoples of Japan and China and Russia on their, you know, eastern coast, that's the western part of the Pacific, they've experienced this jellyfish before, and a lot of the reports of the severity of the stinging comes from that part of the world. Now, our jellyfish that we've got now in New Jersey, this clinging jellyfish population that we're currently looking at, is very, very closely related. It's not identical, but it's like 99.6% related in terms of its DNA content in the regions that we've sequenced so far. So that suggests to us that, you know, this may be the origin, and, you know, how it got from Asia to the New Jersey coast is again a great question, and something we might be able to eventually sort of tease apart by looking at the genomes of these organisms. But
do you think they might have hitched a ride on a vessel?
Yeah, that's probably the main theory that the people are passing around now. So there's a lot of big tanker traffic between Asia and the eastern United States, and these big tanker trucks, big tanker boats, you know, take on ballast water in one location and then spit it out when they get somewhere else, and they do that to sort of balance the load. So there could very easily have been some issues where, you know, ballast water was taken up in Asia and then released, you know, in New York Harbor or, you know, Philadelphia's harbor or anywhere else along the seacoast. So that's one mechanism that, you know, these species might have actually sort of hitched a ride, you know, around the world.
Jacob, yeah. A final question to you, sure, before we have to say goodbye. I saw a headline saying jellyfish apocalypse. I mean, should we be afraid, very afraid, that jellyfish seem to be reproducing?
Well, there are a lot of people who are worried about it because there have been very severe consequences. If you sort of do some searching, you'll find, you know, stories that tell you about how 5 nuclear power plants around the world have been shut down.
That's right.
With jellyfish clogging their water cooling intake pipes. Japanese fishermen who essentially are losing their livelihood because they have this giant jellyfish, the genus is called Nemura, over off of the coast of Japan, and they can't catch fish because these gigantic jellyfish are clogging your nets. So there are lots of people who are worried about this. And one of the issues, I think, is that as our waters degrade, as they become more polluted, as they become warmer, the jellyfish seem to thrive under those conditions, right? So they, you know, and that sort of aggravates this particular situation. We just had a conference last month that my colleague, Dr. Bologna, and one of our graduate students, Dina Restaino, went to in Barcelona. It was the International Jellyfish Bloom Symposium, and this was the 5th time they've met. So there
Jack, I hate to do this to you,
okay,
only because they're playing my song. I got to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
I learned a lot about jellyfish from our guest, John Gaynor from Montclair State University. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, Tom Steyer, is a billionaire. He's an environmentalist and founder of Next Gen Climate. He has spent millions of dollars in support of environmental candidates over the last few years. Next Gen Climate has teamed up with the AFL-CIO, AFSCME, the American Federation of Teachers, or I think that's AFT, and the National
County and Municipal Workers.
Yes, and the National Education Association to form a super PAC, and it's called For Our Future. They want to raise $50 million and elect Democrats to the White House and to Congress. Tom Steyer has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me, Marty.
So what's the mission, the goal for Our Future super PAC?
Well, the goal is to engage working families in the electoral process, to talk to them about progressive issues that matter to them, things like inclusive prosperity, supporting good public schools, supporting racial justice, and working against climate change.
When you say working families, who do you mean?
We mean families where people are, you know, middle class, working class, out there, not necessarily feeling connected to the political process, but having real interests and making sure they engage them on the issues to know that both the issues really, really matter and also that their vote is incredibly important and has incredible impact both in terms of who wins and how politicians view them, how people running for office think about them because their vote is so important.
Why do you need a super PAC? I mean, you have spent millions of dollars over the years to get certain kinds of candidates elected with some mixed success. But why do you need a super PAC?
Well, I think what this organization really is going to do is traditional field work, the kind of old-fashioned democracy that has existed in the United States since the 1700s. And that is the kind of thing of going door to door and talking to people face to face. It is doing phone banking. It is engaging voters on the issues to talk to them about what really matters to Americans right now. And so why do you need this organization? This organization is dedicated to that kind of voter-to-voter contact. And in order to do that, you have to, it's actually a big organizational challenge. You know, that doesn't just happen. You don't just call up a TV or radio station and place an ad. You really have to have human beings on the ground working. And, you know, that doesn't happen overnight.
Will there be ads, though? Ads that will say, you know, at the bottom will say, for our future, Super PAC brought you this message?
That is what people think about when they say use the word Super PAC.
Yes.
But actually, this is all about a field organization, about voter-to-voter contact and the kind of, you know, issue-based discussion that, you know, we think is the way to really engage people, to make them care and to understand how important their vote is.
Is that taking a page from Bernie Sanders, for instance, who certainly has been able to engage a certain kind of voter?
Well, it's interesting because Senator Sanders definitely did engage voters in a very emotional and powerful way on the issues. But you could also say that it's taking a page from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, from Abraham Lincoln, from any of the great Americans. I mean, that is how American democracy traditionally has worked. Americans engage when they have a conversation with someone they trust on a longer basis. That's how they think about their opinions. That's how they reconsider their opinions. That's how they get engaged. When you think about a television ad, the half-life of a television ad is 7 days.
So in people forget it after
you don't
that.
Even know you saw it.
Well, and certainly when you get to November, October, who's going to absorb this information
We're really doing something different than that. We're really trying to build an on-the-ground organization that engages working families and isn't over on Election Day, but actually is something where we really are trying to get back to old-fashioned American democracy in the best sense.
There were some unions and even union members that were unhappy that Next Gen Climate was teaming up with the AFL-CIO and some of these other unions saying, well, because your group opposed Keystone XL Pipeline, which they saw as a potential job creator, that they were uncomfortable with this association. What do you say to them?
Well, I say two things. One is I think any time you do something new, it's going to surprise people and some people may not understand it and it may make them uncomfortable. So that over time, I think people are going to understand better who we are. And let me say what our mission is. The mission of Next Gen Climate is to prevent climate disaster and to promote prosperity for every American. So from the very founding of our organization, we've had a dual purpose. It's always been really important to us that as we address the climate issue, we do it in the context of shared prosperity.
Jobs.
Not just jobs, though. We know that accelerating the move to clean energy is going to create net millions of jobs. That we've studied it. We believe that down to our bones. The key to us is, as those jobs are created, that they be good-paying jobs that you can support a family on in dignity, and that they be distributed fairly throughout the communities. So we've always been focused. We know we have to address climate change. We know that addressing climate change will create millions of jobs. The key to us is that those jobs be good jobs and be fairly distributed.
What do you say to people that say it's a hoax? And I mean, certainly Donald Trump has said climate change is a hoax. Others have said as well. One member of Congress took a snowball into Congress to show that, you know, we do indeed have cold weather. What do you say in response to that?
I think at this point we're past having the debate on climate. You know, I think if you look at the peer-reviewed science articles on climate, You can't find a respectable scientist who does not acknowledge the fact that the climate is changing, which you'd have to I don't even understand how you wouldn't acknowledge that.
Because you can see it.
Yes. And it's very carefully monitored by NASA, for instance, does a monthly global temperature. I don't think there's a scientist who doesn't believe that it's caused by human behavior. In fact, the scientific issue is not whether it's happening and caused by human behavior. The scientific issue is why the scientists have so grossly underestimated the speed with which it would happen. The actual scientific data from NASA this year shows that we're actually way ahead of the scientific projections about how fast it's happening. It's actually – there is a huge controversy about why the scientists have been so overly conservative. So I think what we say to politicians and people running for office is not – we're not having a conversation about science. We don't care about your good intentions. We want to know what your program is. Show us the solutions. Show us the specific programs you're willing to back, because at this point we're past – we're not interested in whether it's in your heart.
I was looking at some research just to see sort of generally speaking how the public feels about certain issues – terrorism, jobs, the economy. You have to go way down the list before you get to things like climate change. Now, I realize it's oftentimes it's how a question is framed or posed that can skew this information, but it's not like the top five. And I know for you it's probably the number one.
Well, it depends who you ask. So I'd make 2 points. First of all Americans, including Republicans, believe this is happening and believe the government should address it. But you're right. The question is, who actually considers it one of their top three issues, an issue on which they'll vote? And let me say what group considers it their number one issue. Millennials. People under the age of 30. This is their number one issue. So that's the largest cohort, voting cohort in the United States. So from our standpoint, there's no question that progressives and millennials, this is one of the top three issues. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that those people know what's going on and show up at the polls, because, you know, for them it really is super important. And we also want to educate and engage other Americans on this topic, because we do actually think that we have to address it. But if we address it in an intelligent way, it will create a lot of good paying jobs, make us richer, save us costs on our heating bills, and make the country grow faster.
You made a lot of money as a hedge fund guy. You became a billionaire. Did you have an epiphany? I mean, was there a moment when you said to yourself, I'm really devoting myself to the wrong thing here?
Well, I built a business basically investing money for college endowments and foundations. And my wife and I have 4 kids. So there was a period of time during which I was an entrepreneur with 4 little kids and pretty much had my head down. What forced
you weren't paying attention, you mean?
I that took all my attention. What really made me raise my head and ask was when I realized in the first couple of years of George W. Bush's administration that he might destroy the country. And I felt like, you know what? I got to start worrying about that, because I don't want my grandchildren to say, what did you do while President Bush was destroying the country? And I would say, well, I wasn't paying attention. So right then I took a much bigger view. And then I started to get really involved. I worked very hard for John Kerry, was very disappointed and surprised when Secretary Kerry didn't become president. I think he would have been a wonderful president. I think it would have been much better for the United States. But once my head was up, I don't know if it was an epiphany, but it was a much broader view of the world. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's some things that I can try to make a contribution on and which would be, you know, I'd really like to do.
You endorsed Hillary Clinton. I know you were sort of back and – I'm not sure if you were back and forth, but why did you endorse her over Bernie Sanders, who probably is a little more green, if I can put it that way, than Hillary Clinton?
Well, what we had been doing was really trying to engage voters on the issues and lay out for them the facts and let them make the decision. So I endorsed Secretary Clinton after the California primary, because our feeling was – we want to be involved with as many people as possible. We don't want them to turn us off because we're telling them what to do. Rather, we want to force the candidates to give us the information, hold them accountable, then make that information available to the people we're interacting with, which is, you know, over 200 college campuses, and let them make a decision rather than telling them what to do. We felt like engage on the issue. And then once the voters had a chance to make their decisions, we said, look, we've asked the candidates from both parties to lay out their solutions to climate, I can tell you the difference between the presumptive Democratic candidate and the presumptive Republican candidate are the biggest I've ever seen in my lifetime. And there's no question who's by far better, which is Secretary Clinton. And therefore, that's why I personally endorsed her. But our goal was to let the voters speak. And it's very consistent with what I'm talking about in terms of this organization that we're doing with these labor unions, which is to say, engage voters on the issues and let them use that. We really believe in broad-based American democracy and American intelligence.
I mean, it sounds like it was a decision that let the process go to the end, but also a practical vote as well, or practical consideration as well.
Well, I wouldn't say it's so much practical. I'd say it really is out of respect for the voters. We really do feel that all the academic studies show not only is that the broader democracy, the better the decision. And so that's our goal always, is to get as many people involved and included, and that if they bring their collective intelligence to bear, that's smarter than anybody.
That's Tom Steyer. He's founder of Next Gen Climate, and his organization is teaming up with the AFL-CIO, AFSCME, AFT, and NEA to form a super PAC for our future. I think I got that right. And he's been telling us about what they want to do and why. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Agnes from Chesterfield, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Agnes. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't have a lot of trouble backing Hillary because of her endorsement of fracking all over the globe. And I just heard that the Democratic Committee, the platform, rejected a ban on fracking. And I just don't – how are you going to force people to stop, you know, supporting fossil fuels?
No, that's
my dilemma.
No, it's a fair question. Tom Steyer, go ahead.
Well, we agree that the most important thing we can do is move off fossil fuels absolutely as fast as possible. We think that we should never build another energy plant based on fossil fuels. We think that the costs of renewables have come down dramatically so that we can actually save money, and the costs will continue to come down. And we think that we can move to, on a extended big grid, 80 to 90% renewables right now.
Right now, this very moment?
Well,
you have to build the infrastructure.
Yeah, we'd have to the grid would have to be better, and we'd have to make it bigger. There'd have to be high voltage lines that go between regions so we can take advantage of a load shifting and the time of day and all those things. But there's no question that we absolutely have to move as fast as possible to do that.
But do you think Hillary Clinton senses that urgency and sees those options?
She does. I think that what she's been trying to do, and I don't want to speak for Secretary Clinton, but we've asked her to, you know, lay out her program. And her program doesn't include a ban on fracking. And she's refused to do that. And Agnes, I know that you're right, that the platform doesn't include that. I think what her program is trying to do, it's really emphasizing a move to clean energy. And she is talking about getting to 50% clean energy by 2025. And that is if we can do that, that's pretty fast. It's going to push a lot of states to move faster than their plans are. And if we're really going to get there, that is going to be an ambitious political move. Because when we look at this, we see it on a couple of dimensions, and there's the scientific dimension and the technological dimension, what we're able to do. But then you can look around the United States of America, and, you know, in California, we're already, you know.
Where you live, right?
Yeah, I'm from San Francisco, California. We've already have a law that says we have to be 50% renewables by 2030, but there are lots of parts of the United States that are very, very low on renewables. And to get to 50% renewables as a country by 2025 will be – that means we're going to put our shoulder to the wheel. So I know that Secretary Clinton has not supported a ban on fracking, but her program
in spite of that, is pretty darn aggressive. And, you know, I think it's going to be a question of if we can get there, that is going to be a big move. The question is, how are we going to get there? And then how are we going to get much further? Because the fact of the matter is we absolutely have to move away from these fossil fuels as fast as possible.
And in fact, our third guest will be talking about the environmental platforms of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Here's an email, and I'm sure you get this all the time, Tom Steyer, from Richard. In what ways does NextGen Climate, a product of a hedge fund profiteer, addressing the issues of systemic problems specific to industrial capitalism? But in what way? Here, I mean, I'm assuming NextGen Climate comes from the money that you made as a hedge fund person.
So I made my money investing on behalf of foundations and college endowments. And my goal has been since I have really picked my eyes up to make sure that actually the system that we have in the United States works for everybody's benefit. And I think that there's no question that it has gotten skewed. And so I want to be pushing along with a bunch of other people to make sure that we address the deep-seated issues that are affecting Americans. We can see in this campaign that there are an awful lot of Americans who feel as if the system has stopped taking account of them, doesn't really acknowledge the impact of policies on them. I think there are a lot of Americans who are incredibly frustrated with the political system. And so I don't think by any stretch we should be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But I think that we need to make some very different choices. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, I think that I can make a contribution on this along with a lot of other Americans.
Well, we have to end our conversation. Tom Steyer, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the founder of NextGen Climate. They've teamed up with a bunch of unions to form a super PAC called For Our Future. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's environmental policies. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you believe in climate change, you believe it's real or it's a hoax. If you support the Paris Climate Agreement or you want it torn up. If you want more investment in renewable energy or in fossil fuel jobs, then you have a choice this election season. The presumptive nominees, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald Trump, have very different views about the environment. Our guest, Rachel Levin, has been tracking this for Bloomberg's BNA Environmental Desk and joins us as we round out this hour on Radio Times. And Rachel Levin, nice to have you with us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I put this actually to our second guest. Basically, when you look at polling and what Americans, what they think are the most important issues, you don't tend to see environmental issues at the top or even near the top of that list. Why do you think that is?
You know, there's a lot of thoughts on that front. I mean, some of the thoughts are that you don't really hear about these issues until there's a problem. So, for instance, Flint, Michigan's drinking water crisis has brought a lot of attention to drinking water problems and existing lead contamination problems with our drinking water. But that's something that we don't think about on a daily basis. We just assume that we're getting safe drinking water. So I would think that would be one reason.
Well, and I just want to underscore what I said in my introduction, which is based in many ways on what you've been writing about, is that if the choice is Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and it's looking that way, at least as of today, voters are going to have a real choice if they have opinions about environmental issues.
Yes, definitely. They're almost exact opposite on environmental issues in a lot of ways.
Well, let's break it down or break it apart. For instance, on the whole issue of climate change, where does Hillary Clinton stand? Where does Donald Trump stand?
Yes. Well, Donald Trump thinks that climate change is a hoax. At least those are his latest statements. He's been saying that pretty much since he's been running for president. But he's called climate change a hoax. He said that it's a ploy by China to hurt the U.S. economy. While Hillary Clinton has accepted that climate change is real, she said that it's largely caused by human activity, and she thinks that we need to take an aggressive role in limiting the impacts of climate change and addressing and preparing for that.
We just had a caller who was talking about Hillary Clinton and fracking, but let's talk about where the candidates stand on natural gas and fracking, which, of course, is an important issue here in Pennsylvania. Where does Hillary Clinton stand on that issue?
So Hillary Clinton actually is a little bit more moderate than her Democratic opponent, Senator Bernie Sanders. She has said that she doesn't know if it would be legal to outright ban hydraulic fracturing on federal lands, but she has said that she would impose aggressive regulations for hydraulic fracturing to the point that in some areas you might not be able to frack there at all, while Donald Trump has said that he would limit regulations in general and open up more land, especially for hydraulic fracturing.
Does she talk about natural gas as a bridge fuel, as some people have?
Yes, yes. She's definitely made comments about natural gas as a bridge fuel. She said that we need to prepare for the time when we'll have enough renewables to power our economy in our country, but at this point that would be difficult and it needs to be a steady and sustainable transition.
She got in some trouble for some words that she said in coal country, although when you put them in context, they made a lot more sense. What did she say about coal and how should we understand her position on that?
You know, Hillary Clinton's position on coal is that coal as a market resource it's going out of business, and it's not going out of business because of regulations necessarily. A lot of that is just market forces. So her comments are generally taken as opposing the coal industry and coal country. And I think that where she is coming from is more of a place of, you know, the market is forcing coal out. Sustainably, we can't continue using coal as a main energy resource with all of the impacts of climate change. So we need to prepare for that future.
In fact, she seems to be saying, I think others are saying, that it's really natural gas that is having a big impact on the coal industry.
Yes. Yeah. They're saying that natural gas has, as it's become a cheaper fuel and with methods like hydraulic fracturing, she said that, you know, natural gas is pushing coal out because it is just cheaper and more available.
Now, how about Donald Trump and where he stands on fossil fuel production?
He wants more of it. He wants the U.S. to not only be energy secure in terms of producing all of its own energy, but he wants it to be an energy exporter, and he thinks that that would be great for the economy. He thinks it would be helpful for the world in general for us to be able to provide those fossil fuel resources elsewhere.
And does he see it as tied to the economy?
Yes, it's a key part of his idea of bringing jobs back to the U.S. He thinks that if you bring coal jobs back, if you bring more energy production, specifically fossil fuel production, to the U.S., that produces jobs in a sustainable way, and that will help the U.S. economy and individuals in the United States.
Are the candidates still talking about the Keystone XL pipeline? And I say that because it was rejected by the Obama administration in the fall. Hillary Clinton, of course, Secretary of State, while there was a fair amount of thinking about where the U.S. stands on that, is this still a live issue?
You know, it had kind of gone away in the Democratic primary, and it had kind of gone away in the Republican primary because all of the candidates within each party had similar stances. But there's a chance that it could be revived in the general election. Hillary Clinton is opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline, agrees with the Obama administration's decision, while Donald Trump has said that he supports the Keystone XL pipeline. He hopes that TransCanada, the company that owns the potential Keystone XL pipeline, will resubmit their permitting application. And he said that he would get a better deal for the United States within that permitting application, although it isn't clear how he would do that.
And is it clear that that application would be resubmitted under a Donald Trump?
It's not for sure. TransCanada has I mean, obviously indicated that they're still interested in the pipeline, but they have made comments along the lines of, you know, the permitting process is set in stone, and this isn't really a give and take here. If you permit the pipeline, then that's, you permit the pipeline. There isn't a lot more profits for the United States citizens to be getting out of that deal beyond that.
And that's Rachel Levin. She's an environmental reporter for Bloomberg and the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We've been looking at the presumptive presidential nominee comparison when it comes to environmental issues, whether it is fossil fuels or clean energy, renewable energy, whether they believe in climate change or not. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Curious about how important you think it is that the candidates talk about these issues, and how important are they to you or not. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How about the Paris, Rachel, the Paris Climate Agreement? Where do the candidates stand on that?
Sure. The Paris Climate Agreement is a point where they are, again, in stark opposition to each other. Hillary Clinton is strongly supportive of the Paris Climate Agreement, while Donald Trump has said he would renegotiate the agreement and later on has said that he would actually cancel the Paris Climate Agreement. He is strongly opposed.
Strongly opposed. And there are certainly differences of opinion when it comes to things like the EPA, the kinds of regulations that come out of the EPA. And it seems that, Rachel, is an issue that people have very strong feelings about.
Yes, people definitely have strong feelings about the EPA on either side. And that goes beyond the presidency. The EPA has kind of become the poster child for Republicans to talk about overregulation by the Obama administration and how that affects the economy, although Democrats would strongly dispute a lot of their statements on that. Hillary Clinton would stand behind all of the Obama administration's main regulations, such as the Waters of the U.S. rule, which helps to protect clean waters, and the Clean Power Plan, while Donald Trump would basically oppose all of those regulations that were promulgated by the EPA under the Obama administration. And in fact, he's made statements to the extent that he would try to abolish the EPA, although he's kind of stepped back on that.
Let me get, looks like John from Sarasota, Florida, to join us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Great weather, Sarasota, Florida.
Go ahead. Rub it in. Go ahead, John.
Okay, rubbing it in. Isn't Hillary Clinton's stance on TPP actually going to increase the value of the energy that we would receive from fracking?
Can you answer that, Rachel?
This is,
of course, the trade deal. Yes.
Yeah. So Hillary Clinton's stance on the Transatlantic Pacific Partnership has shifted over time, and she has said that she's opposed to the deal in general. I hope that answers your question. I'm not quite sure. I didn't hear the specifics.
Yeah, and that might be about the best that we can do for you, John. Would it be fair, though, Rachel, to say that Bernie Sanders, who still is running, has not conceded, that he pushed Hillary Clinton more to the left when it comes to environmental issues?
Yes, Senator Bernie Sanders has definitely pushed Hillary Clinton to the left, or at least to be more vocal on her stances on certain environmental issues, although environmental groups have said that they also played a strong role in that by catching her at campaign events and getting her on camera and kind of sending those statements out. That's how we've gotten a lot of her stances on whether or not federal lands should have moratoriums put over them for certain fossil fuel production, especially.
I wonder, too, and this is sort of traditional in presidential politics, is the primary, the Republicans tend to veer right, the Democrats tend to veer left, and then when the general comes, they sort of meet somewhere in the middle. Do you anticipate, especially on these issues, there's some kind of a middle ground when fall rolls around, Rachel?
You know, I think that a lot in the energy industry would hope so, but most political observers are kind of observing and guessing that there isn't going to be a lot of a shift in this election as opposed to previous elections. The fundamentals are so different for each of the candidates. So minor shifts won't change the ultimate stances of these candidates and the gap that's between them. But also the candidates are really working to reach their bases. And in the Republican primary, we got a glimpse of how Donald Trump debates individuals. And a lot of that was less about the policy and more rhetoric. And so a lot of people are expecting that to bleed into the general.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We have a tweet from Katie. I had a question about this as well, Rachel, saying, well, what about third-party candidates? We have more choices than just Hillary Clinton and Trump, and there's a Green Party candidate, for instance, Jill Stein.
Yeah, I mean, third-party candidates, no matter what, will face an uphill battle. In this election, it seems like the candidates are, neither of them for the primary parties are well-liked by the American public, but even as a third-party candidate in this election, there's still a stark difference in how much money you're going to be able to get to campaign, how much airtime, how seriously you're going to be taken. So I think we'll probably still end up seeing a Republican or Democratic president.
Are there any environmental issues that you're looking at, perhaps even that the candidates haven't really addressed yet?
You know, they've really touched on all of the basics. I think it would be interesting to hear more specifics from Donald Trump, which is what we've started to hear as he's clinched the number of delegates that he would need to become the Republican Party nominee. As he started to talk about drought and different energy policies, post that benchmark for him, he's gotten a lot more specific. And I think if we can hear a little bit more about what his plan is for oil and gas and coal on federal land, how he would like to bring those jobs back, that's a big question. I mean, is it possible for him to bring those jobs back? Those kind of details will be interesting to watch for.
He did say in California that they didn't have a drought. You mentioned the word drought, but he said it didn't exist in California.
Yeah, he did. He said it didn't. He said he questioned whether it existed. And he kind of talked through what is widely a Republican talking point on drought, looking at ways to address it. But he didn't seem to. He said the top line was potentially not understanding a lot of the nuance of the issue. So it was an interesting glimpse into Donald Trump getting into these policy issues, because he obviously has a lot to learn coming from outside of Washington directly into the fray.
Have you ever covered a presidential campaign before?
No, this will be my first.
Well, welcome aboard. Rachel Levin, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's an environmental reporter for Bloomberg. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.